Hello, everyone, and welcome to the American Immigration Lawyers Association's podcast entitled Setting Up a Global Outbound Immigration Practice. I'm JJ Area, AILA's Education and Resources Associate, and it is my pleasure to introduce today's panel. The discussion leader for this podcast is Ellen Freeman, a member of the AILA Global Migration Section Steering Committee from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Joining Ellen is Jane Carroll, the AILA Global Migration Section Steering Committee co-chair from Chicago, Illinois, and Todd Fowler from Austin, Texas. At this time, I'd like to turn the podcast over to Ellen.
Thank you, JJ. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, everyone. Thank you so much for joining us to discuss an exciting topic of setting up a global outbound immigration practice. Global immigration practice existed for many years, but I would say about 10 years, and especially 6-7 years ago, many U.S.-based immigration attorneys started being asked questions about helping their clients with various issues around the world. And at that time, corporate clients found out that maybe it's not always convenient for them to go exclusively through the relocation provider company and rely on their immigration services, that when the company already had a U.S. immigration lawyer, they naturally started turning to U.S. immigration lawyer with questions about immigration issues around the world. And at that time, the interest section within American Immigration Lawyers Association started forming, and that was the Global Migration Section as it's known today. We have been very active for the last 5 years in AILA, and if you would to look on the AILA website under AILA Resources, Global Migration Section has a special section with a digest, with several podcasts recorded there as well, and with a lot of background information on various countries and their structure. The role of the U.S. immigration attorney in global immigration practice can be very different. I would describe it on a spectrum, from a simple introduction to an attorney in another country who you want to know and make sure that when you make this introduction that it's going to be a productive relationship between your client and this attorney and that you will be thanked for making this introduction rather than witnessing problems. So again, it could be just an introduction, and it could be as much as completely participating in the process, being copied on every email, participating in the process, and even up to the point we have a lot of U.S. immigration lawyers who came from other countries or maybe studied in other countries and licensed in other international jurisdictions. So sometimes they provide services not only in the U.S., but also in another country where they're based or where they're licensed. And we'll talk about the ethical issues of providing unauthorized services or the role of U.S. immigration lawyers, but I wanted to set it up in the beginning of our discussion. I will turn now to Jane to speak about the introduction and terminology of the global migration practice.
Thank you, Ellen. I think it's very wise that you are directing us to start off with understanding many of the terms and the concepts for global immigration, because they can be very different from those we find in U.S. immigration. I think that one of the big traps that U.S. practitioners can fall into is transferring the concepts of U.S. immigration laws onto the systems of other jurisdictions. Like, for example, in the U.S., we're accustomed to working with the concepts of non-immigrant visas and immigrant visas. Those might not be terms or concepts that are used in any other country that you're dealing with. So it is very important to understand the immigration concepts, the terminologies, the processes used in particular jurisdictions. Make sure that you understand. And if you don't, or if you have questions, make sure that you ask and work with your local counsel to have a firm understanding of what you're discussing. Conversely, the lawyer or immigration professional in another country with whom you're working might already assume that you understand some of those concepts, and perhaps they might not be clear in communicating those concepts to you. So again, just make sure that the communication is solid between you and the counsel that you're working with. And remember that often you as the attorney might be called upon to explain the concepts and the processes to your client back in the U.S. So let's go over some of the common terms that are used in global immigration. One that you'll hear a lot is global assignment. Global assignment is often defined internally by the company itself and does not necessarily correspond to the length or duration of a work permit or work authorization in a particular country. So don't confuse the two or assume that a company's internal global assignment policy aligns in any way with the country's work permit requirements. It'd be very different things. Generally speaking, global assignments are often defined as long-term, so that could be an assignment, say, of in excess of 12 months. It could be short-term, and that's typically anywhere from, say, 3 to 12 months. It could be extended business travel, and that could be, say, 3 months or less. It could be commuter, which would be regular trips of several weeks. It could be a rotational assignment, and that can be used for different purposes, for example, for developing talent, for developing experience, providing the kind of background that would lead to a promotion or maybe would help encourage to retain the employee. And sometimes it's also used for backfilling a position for a while. Localization is another term you'll hear within global assignment, and localization means transitioning employees from a long-term assignment to a local salary structure and benefit scheme. And then you'll hear about one-way permanent assignment, and that's intended to be a one-way move with the employee transferred to the payroll of the new company, of the new entity, with no ongoing financial support provided and no intent or expectation to repatriate the employee after a specific period of time. Moving on to another very popular term is global mobility. This global mobility refers to the full scope of considerations related to the global movement of people. So it takes into consideration tax, immigration, compensation, benefits, relocation. What are we going to do with the dog? You know, it's the full, so immigration is only one aspect of this very full and complicated global mobility process. Another term that you're going to hear is secondment. A secondment is an arrangement typically used when an employee or even a group of employees is temporarily assigned to work in a different location or for a different organization for a specific period of time. They are often informal third-party arrangements, third-party placements, but the secondment agreement must clearly state who will be the employer during the secondment period. Another term is totalization agreements. Excuse me. Totalization agreements are between nations for the purpose of protecting the benefit rights of workers who divide their work between or among two or more countries. So the agreements are intended to avoid situations where employers or employees are required to pay Social Security taxes or health care taxes to two or more countries based upon the same employee earnings. Work permit, another very common term, is an official document giving a foreigner permission to take up employment in that country. It is usually a separate document from a visa. And then another concept that's widely used is residence permit. And you'll find residence permit is used throughout most European countries, the Middle East, Latin America, Asia, Africa. And a residence permit is the necessary authorization to allow a foreigner to stay in the country for a specific period of time. So the residence permit is often a separate authorization from a work permit or a visa. And it's not to be confused with the U.S. concept of legal permanent residence. So there, that's just a few defined terms, enough to get you going. Ellen, I'll pass it back to you.
Thank you, Jane. I also wanted in this part to mention some of the documentation that you as a U.S. attorney or somebody starting a global immigration practice may be asked to provide or assist with when a foreign national working in the United States is being sent on an international assignment or been localized or sent to another country. One of those concepts is apostille. So in the United States, as U.S. immigration lawyers, we're used to filing, for example, applications for adjustment of status. When we file those applications, we include copies of documents. Nobody asks us to provide original documents. When we assist our clients with consular processing, non-immigrant or immigrant visa petitions in other countries, they do present original documents. But those original documents are simply issued by the country of issuance, their passport or birth certificate or marriage certificate. In cases where foreign nationals apply to international assignments or being sent abroad, many of the times their documents have to be authenticated separately, and just presenting original document is not enough. That is when a person needs an apostille, which is common in European jurisdictions, Latin American jurisdictions, where a notary plays much larger part than a regular notary public in the United States, and the documents gets attached with a seal, and that's where the word apostille comes from. So in the United States, for example, if it's an American citizen who is being sent on assignment abroad and applying for a residency permit or a particular visa abroad, you may have to assist them with apostilling documents. And the Department of State of a particular state which issued that document would assist with the process. Many of the times, U.S. citizens or foreign nationals going on international assignments need to secure FBI clearances, and those take a long time. However, there are particular companies which are called channelers, and there are several of them, which can help to expedite FBI clearance process, which normally can take many months, and of course, in our world, nobody has that much time. I will now turn to Todd to speak about specific different types of visas that you will encounter when dealing with global international assignments.
Thanks so much, Ellen. I'd like to just provide a framework is most helpful for understanding the different general types of either work visa, work permit, or whatever the ultimate underlying document that you'll be seeking for your client that will allow for both work and residence rights within the country of assignment. I think speaking in generalities is very helpful, but I'll provide, an example of each general type, within a specific country's program. As in the U.S., there's several different classifications, obviously, for each country, and I'll also just highlight the most commonly used or popular or generally appropriate for our professional clients. Starting first with one of the more straightforward and systematic countries and classifications would be a fairly standard single filing work permit application in the country that would be analogous to a U.S. H-1B category. And I would use the framework of Singapore's employment pass program to highlight that type. It's typically a single filing with the single government authority that has authorization to issue the work and residence authorization. Singapore specifically has a fairly high-tech, updated, interconnected employment pass system that allows you to file applications through their online portal, attach supporting materials and signed applications through that portal, and have that portal it's registered to a company user or possible third-party immigration advisor. That portal interacts with other components of Singapore government authorities, specifically with tax authorities and others, so that it's kind of a one-stop shop for everything that's needed for an immigration filing. And that's a fairly, I think, unique but sophisticated system wherein original documents are not required. The application is processed, filed electronically, approved via email notification, and then upon arrival into the country, the individual would then submit themselves for biometrics and ultimately have their employment pass card issued. A second type to be familiar with is countries that allow an employment visa to be issued directly at their foreign consulates abroad without any specific pre-approval or in-country steps that need to take place, such as a labor market test or a immigration authority approval. Countries such as India are, I think, very prevalent with their employment visa process, wherein we are able to assist our clients with filing employment visa applications directly at Indian consulates abroad. The supporting materials and documents, of course, need to establish the entity and the job opportunity and registration of the local Indian host company. But as I said before, there's not a preliminary or interim step or approval process that's needed from within India in order to make that application with the consulate directly in the United States. A third system or type of process to be aware of, I think, is somewhat more analogous with our H-1B system in the United States, and thinking about that from the perspective of having there be first some form of labor market test or advertisement or notice to be undertaken, and subsequently a petition or application to be filed with the relevant immigration authority from within the country. Upon approval of that that application, an individual then being able to apply for a either an entrance or employment visa at that foreign country's consulate abroad, and then upon entry, completing any necessary post-arrival steps such as a local registration, address registration, police notification of some sort, so that there's a post-arrival step as well. I think that those steps are fairly common throughout countries in Europe, and so those are certainly components of a process that you can see are very different from what is somewhat straightforward direct consular filing in order to obtain the authorization to travel to and work within India, to a online but basically in-country filing in order to obtain the work and residence rights through the employment pass in Singapore, and then the multi-layered, multi-step that are typically associated with, work and residence rights within a lot of European countries. Ellen and Jane, that's kind of the three things that I wanted to highlight. Did you want to touch base on anything else specific or move on to the next point?
Absolutely correct. Would like to mention here that planning is paramount, because just like with U.S. immigration issues, a lot of the times we are made aware of somebody's assignment abroad or the necessity to travel abroad, whether for short or long-term period, on a very short notice. And it's very important to at least understand the framework, the legal framework of a particular country that we have to deal with, to know how long before somebody's employee can be placed in another jurisdiction and what visa options are available. In some countries, it is possible to secure a visitor's visa while the work permit type or another type of a visa may be pending. And there are specific exclusions to particular general laws that will enable a foreign national whose skills are unique, for example, to come into the country and until engage in some limited activities. So it's very important to engage with a particular legal counsel from a specific jurisdiction to find out what options are available.
Yeah, and Ellen, I think you made raised a very good point with the documentation with apostilles and the authentication of documents, because sometimes that can take months, and that can be a real surprise to the people, especially for U.S. attorneys who possibly have not dealt with authenticating documents, just how long it can take, and that can really throw a spanner in the works in terms of timing for your work authorization.
Sometimes you even have to obtain a second original copy of a birth or marriage certificate, because in order for a document to be apostilled, it has to be fresh. A lot of the times an old document or a copy of the document cannot be apostilled, so there is an extra time there. So again, it's very, very important to know those rules and also know how to find specific rules in a specific jurisdiction. And we come to our next point of discussion about identifying and working with foreign legal counsel. I must say as a preface that the Global Migration Section is an excellent source that didn't exist even 5 years ago in terms of the list of attorneys who were vetted, who were accepted by American Immigration Lawyers Association as international associates. So they're not full-fledged members of AILA like us, but they have been vetted. We know that they have been accepted in their jurisdictions. They have recommendations, and they participate sort of as friends with our organization and provide services to our clients. If you were to go any day now on AILA website and pull the list of international associates, you would see dozens listed in major jurisdictions such as Canada, Australia, United Kingdom. But you will find members in Africa and in very small jurisdictions in Latin America or in countries where none of your friends or colleagues have ever encountered legal counsel. So I will turn now to Todd to speak about his experience and his advice on identifying and working with foreign legal counsel.
Yeah, thanks again, Ellen. I think, you know, the most important part, or the end goal, I guess, of identifying and working with foreign legal counsel is trust. And being, you know, a U.S. immigration attorney, being confident that the advice that we're receiving from local counsel is of course 100% correct, compliant, consistent, and useful, and so that's obviously the end goal in working with local counsel, you know, abroad. And you know, the question is, how do we get there? as Ellen's outlined, AILA obviously has a great starting point for building your network or reaching out to, you know, possibly several different local councils or immigration service providers in a specific country or region that you may have need from your clients for assistance with. And, you know, typically the first step from my perspective is, you know, getting that person on the phone after, of course, reviewing their website if they have any or any additional credentials or information, and simply speaking with them, maybe not even about a immediate case at hand, possibly, of course, to solicit some additional information and test their knowledge and experience, but really getting a feel for them, how they work, what is their, you know, their ethical compass. How do you think that you would be able to work with them? And in countries where, or countries or clients where the client will have more direct interaction, either personally with that individual or their team through a local in-country registration process or some else that they'll be assisting with personally in-country, how can they present themselves? Do they present themselves as professional? I think those are really, really great initial things to think about. A second point I'll make is that also using your own internal network, even outside of AILA, knowing others that practice in this field, and when I get an inquiry from a colleague at another firm, I am, more generally than not, glad to pass on good or bad information or references on those that we have experience with or knowledgeable about. And so, again, AILA or your own personal network of attorneys and colleagues are definitely a great source of initial information. Jane, did you have any other points you wanted to raise on, how you or your team kind of identify and work with foreign local counsel?
Well, yeah, and I'm a great proponent of the global migration section as well, and our incredible sort of community of international associates within AILA. But in terms of getting down to the nitty-gritty of actually working with local counsel, I think one of the most important things that you as the attorney can do is make sure that everyone understands what their particular role in the process is. What role will you play, if any, as the attorney sitting in the U.S.? What roles and responsibility will the attorney play locally? Who are members of the team locally that might be working with the attorney? As you've mentioned, there are in-country registrations often. There are medical exams that might need to be submitted, police registrations, all kinds of things. Who is going to be assisting with that? Who's going to be helping? I think mapping all of that out, whether it's on a phone call, teleconference, whatever, getting everybody on board, understanding what's going to happen, who is doing what time frames we're looking at. Clear communication is absolutely critical to making this whole process work. I think that one of the big mistakes that a U.S. attorney could make in working with local counsel is to say, oh, good, now I've got the best attorney in, whatever country working on this, and, my role's out. I don't need to worry about this anymore. And that's not true. I mean, you do have to make sure that you communicate and communicating back to your client and making sure that things are moving along as they should be. That's really kind of your role as the U.S. attorney in this, is to sort of be the quarterback and make sure that everybody understands what's happening. And that way you get much smoother, we hope, uncomplicated global assignments.
Right.
Yeah, I agree, Jane. And to build off that, I think one other important concept is absolutely mapping out and having clearly identified and established roles. But also within working with the local counsel, maintaining the ability for flexibility based on specific client preferences and needs. And I think that is really proven successful in my practice, is that, it's not a one-size fit-all for global immigration, how it's handled within a country or by one provider, and that, certain clients like to have different levels of interaction or visibility on different aspects of a process. And I think or expectations that map what they do on their U.S. immigration side. And I think it's very important also to establish that with the local counsel as you begin your relationship with them on a general level as to how you expect to work together, but also on a client-by-client basis and how they need to, just like we do, need to conform to how the client maintains their business and what their policies are.
I think it's also important to understand that the calls with the local council, the oversight of new or relatively new jurisdiction laws and procedure can take a lot of time on the part of the U.S. attorney. And our clients may be used to a flat fee or fixed fee arrangements and don't expect how much work it may take to transfer an employee to another jurisdiction. So it is a discussion that needs to take place up front, because it may end up cost significantly more than the client expects and significantly more of your time that you have ever expected because of the local registration and follow-up and additional unpredictable issues a lot of the times, because some jurisdictions like big European Union countries, UK, Australia, of course, have very defined, very specific immigration law system. And some countries, specifically even like Argentina, have not such a defined system. And so every time we would ask a question working on a particular case, the local counsel would tell us, well, we need to go to the immigration authority and ask them. And my corporate client felt very uncomfortable that their name would be revealed or somebody would be going to an immigration authority and asking a question on their behalf because there is no precedent, for example. And a lot of the times American-based clients don't understand that there may not be a precedent. There may not be a similar case in the past. I also want to add that when you work with a local counsel or you select local counsel, be very choosy and be very, very careful. And why I say so is for several reasons. Number one is because the list of immigration lawyers, the one that are most known and in like main jurisdictions, passed around over and over again. And just like with the U.S., if you only have one case or you have only one question, you become quite unimportant to them, and they want to focus on a larger corporation or a larger U.S. client that constantly sends them business. So there is a point of trying a new counsel and trying somebody who is maybe smaller, younger, starting out, rather than, you know, one attorney that everybody tells you about. That one attorney may be great, but they may become quite unresponsive once they get the client, and you don't always know what will happen. And that local attorney is far away on a different time zone, hard to reach. So be very choosy when selecting a counsel. Keep in mind privacy and confidentiality issues. Some of my corporate clients didn't complain about local counsel, but would say, we would like to change the counsel. And I would ask, well, who is a good counsel in Spain, by way of example? Who should I use in Spain? And then I find out that, lo and behold, the person who was recommended to Spain is already the counsel of my client. And so it would be quite uncomfortable going to them and saying that my client is looking to change local counsel. So you have to be careful and try to find out, have they had experience in this country? Is it the first foray in there, or have they had actual experience, and are they trying to change the counsel so that you don't look like you don't know what's going on? A lot of the times we have trouble finding counsel because it's a smaller jurisdiction or a place where nobody have used the counsel. And every year at our Global Migration Forum, we have a specific panel on finding local counsel. It's such a big issue even for those of us who have been practicing in this area. So two of the advices that I found to be extremely useful is, number one, look at the U.S. Embassy or consulate website. The American Citizen Services always has a list of local attorneys. Some of them may or may not be practitioners in immigration law, and in some countries, immigration law falls under the jurisdiction of regulatory or employment or sometimes even corporate law. But at least through the recommendations of the U.S. Embassy or consulate in another country, you may be able to find local counsel who will assist with immigration or global mobility issues. And another source is looking at the previous system of government in that country. Was it a colony? So if we look at Africa, for example, or sometimes very small jurisdictions in Latin America, so this African country, for example, used to be a colony of Angola. Angola was a colony of Portugal. So if we look at the Portuguese attorney, that Portuguese immigration council may be able to help us with the immigration laws in Angola, because the colony's laws were based on and almost mimicking the main country's rules, and they may have contacts there still. So sometimes that works. And Jane, you had something to add.
Yeah, and one of the basic points when you start working with any local council, foreign council, make sure that you have a written agreement. That is something that often we forget. It's a basic elemental thing that sometimes we forget. But do have that written agreement between you and local council that does outline everything, whether it's terms of payment, how you're going to work, rules of law. Just make it a professional relationship. The other thing I was thinking that you might consider doing, especially if you're dealing with jurisdictions that are that might have less defined laws, do a series of FCPA, Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, or UK Anti-Bribery Act training. I think it's very important that any counsel that you use be aware of and know the rules around, the corruption rules around, U.S. practice and U.K. practice. It's very, very, very important, especially in emerging jurisdictions.
Absolutely. And the culture, you know, even though we know so much about international corporate environments and how each culture is different, it really comes into play when working with local counsel in another country. It's not simply a different time zone. It's a different way of communicating. A lot of the times much more formal than in the United States. They don't necessarily attach just a simple email. It can be a letter that comes via email. And also be very careful because in the United States, the bar of immigration lawyers is very large. There are 11,000 of us. And if you don't like one of us, you can always find someone else. But in a lot of the countries, immigration bar is very, very small. And so things that you say and that you do, they will get back into the United States. They will get back to other immigration lawyers. So parting the relationship, choosing the counsel has a lot more than what we use to in the United States. Another subject that we wanted absolutely to cover in today's podcast is technology, because how do you really set up a practice in today's days and age without the technology? And global migration technology has been behind, obviously, in U.S. immigration. We're used to all these competing products in the market. Each one of us uses a particular software that helps us not only create and keep the forms, but also sets up tickler systems. Well, in global migration, those tickler systems are even more important because there are specific dates when the documents need to be filed, when the registration needs to be attended to, when certain documents come together. And there is no one specific product that really a leader in the marketplace. But I want to direct you to the AILA Infonet document number 14122349, which was posted on December 23rd, 2014. And what it is, it's a Global Migration Digest. Every few months, Global Migration section publishes online on AILA website a publication called Global Migration Digest, and this particular issue addressed the global technology and case management system and gave you pluses and minuses on different products. So for example, if you are already a user of INS Zoom, you may be able to buy an additional portion or select additional portion for global migration. Same goes for Serenade or e-immigration. So pretty much every large product on the market is trying to have a global migration portion. They're rather inexpensive, but they're not very perfect. Those who are more advanced, for example, for global migration practice, such as Imiga, is just set up for global migration, and it's expensive and probably not very convenient for a newer practitioner. Nevertheless, a lot of the times when you participate in an RFP or try to get the work, which will involve global migration work as part of the company's entire immigration work, they always want to know which technology you use, what product you use. Larger law firms have their own proprietary products built specifically for them. And again, there is no perfect product in the market, but there are at least four to choose from. And they're described in great detail in this document. Again, it's 14122349 on AILA Infonet. I want to conclude our podcast with the idea that global immigration practice is very exciting. It's definitely a great benefit to our clients to be able to have a one-stop shopping, come to one attorney. And of course, it's greatly beneficial to you to be able to recapture additional work for the company. You just have to work carefully with the local counsel, have written agreements there, and learn a little bit about the framework so that you understand why you select a particular counsel or why a particular counsel makes a specific recommendation. I thank you very much for your interest in global outbound migration practice, and this concludes our podcast. Thank you so much to Jane and Todd.